If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Truth and Movies. In this instalment, Murder on the Orient Express, we review Kenneth Branagh's steaming whodunit, the perfect film for Christmas because it's a giant turkey. And Greek tragedy, in Yorgos Lanthimos' Killing of a Sacred Deer, Colin Farrell stars as a surgeon with the personality of a sturgeon in this staggering film, which we'll probably fawn over. And Film Club, Halloween special, it's House of the Devil. Truth and Movies, it's a Little White Lies podcast. There you go, that's your lineup today. We think they're interesting films to talk about, but we'll find out together, listeners, in the company of Adam Woodward.
Hello.
And a welcome back to Elena Lazage.
Hello.
What have you been up to, Elena?
Watching movies, writing about them.
Okay, which
living
ones?
Living my life.
Yeah, okay, fine. Fine. Well, we'll get a little window on some of that in the course of this show. Remember, you can get in touch with us, and we do appreciate it when you do, via email, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com, LWLies on Twitter, the Facebook site, and also on the website, where there's a comments section. A couple of people posting on that of late. Harry Jenkins, who was appreciating Hunt for the Wilder People as the film club pick. He says it illustrates how serious and important comedies can be. It was a very poignant allegory for broader relations between white and Maori people. Have you seen that film, Elena, Hunt for the Wilder People?
I actually watched it like last week.
Okay.
On Blu-ray.
And what did you
because
think?
Because I was just I quite liked it, but I not as much as I wanted to.
All right.
I think Taika Waititi's humour is kind of better shown in Thor, which...
Really, yeah.
I don't know.
We had a long chat about Thor last time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Johnny Carrington, Simon Russell Beale on screen. His best film role is in Terence Davis' The Deep Blue Sea. Now, there is one for Film Club. Have you seen that, Adam?
It is, yeah. It's a good shout, that. It's like Tom Hiddleston and Rachel Weisz, I think. It's
really?
Like
a really... Quite a cast.
It's sort of old melodramatic kind of post-war drama. It's very good.
All right. Okay. Well, I like a film with a nice cast, and
wow,
that's certainly what Kenneth Branagh brings us in today's first offering, which is Murder on the Orient Express.
So they got him after all. You assume he was killed?
No, not. Well, he was in perfectly good health. He had his enemies.
Indeed, he was murdered.
God, murder here?
God rest his soul.
Someone was rummaging around my cabin in the middle of the night. No one would listen to me.
If there was a murder...
What is going on?
Then there was a murderer. The murderer is with us.
And every one of you is a suspect.
And who are you?
My name is Hercule Poirot, and I am probably the greatest detective in the world.
His accent's almost as convincing as yours, Elena.
Oh, it's great.
Isn't it? This, not so much a whodunit as a whydunit, I would say. There's a murder on the Orient Express. Happily, the world's greatest detective is on board, and there's snow on the line, which will sound familiar to commuters, and that means he's got loads of time to deduce who the culprit is. Do you have strong feelings about this film, Elena?
No.
I do.
Good.
Kenneth Branagh here with what I think is intended to be a film like they used to make them.
Yes, it does feel like a throwback, and not just in the literal sense of it being an adaptation of a very old and very well-known story. It's not the first time it's been brought to the big screen either. There's a few adaptations I think Sid Lumet did a version in the 70s. It's got much better cast than this, actually. I think you've got John Gielgud and Ingrid Bergman's in it, Lauren Bacall. And there's a TV movie from, I think, like the 90s where they sort of made it shorter by literally cutting the cast in half. So you've only got like six suspects, which is great. This one starts off on a very bizarre note, I think, and gets stranger, and then just kind of grinds to a halt, literally, at the point in which the murder happens. If you know the story and you know the ending and the sort of twist, then, you know, there's really nothing for you to get from this film, I think. He doesn't do anything interesting or kind of new with the story. It's quite a faithful adaptation, I think, suffers for that a little bit.
I also think that because of the nature of the story, which has such a huge cast, I don't think all those actors, because some of them I think are great, like Willem Dafoe is there, even if they're great, like they don't get to do much, so it feels a bit like a waste.
It's a bit like watching a big game of Cluedo taking place on the kind of northern line or something.
It's very much the Kenny B show. I mean, he directs, stars in this. It feels like a massive vanity project. He's given Poirot this ridiculous sort of double-layered moustache, which I'm not sure how faithful it is to the original character, but it was a real distraction for me.
Apparently Agatha Christie fans are up in arms about the lack of verisimilitude of the moustache.
Oh, well, there you go.
But, not the only issue that, by any means, with this film. I think also the fact that they're aiming for that classic old-fashioned film, a well-crafted picture, but it really falls short in so many ways. I think one obvious way is the very clumsy manner in which they've done some product placement in this film. If you're trying to sell this as a prestige movie and you keep hawking boxes of chocolates on the side, what issues did you have with it, Elena?
I think you're saying he tried to make it like a classical movies that we used to do them, but I think it feels, watching the film, that he has not much faith in the material, as in, like, all the dialogue is said really fast, mumbled. The subtleties of the dialogue, which are great, the subtleties of the story, I think, are really amazing and really, like, shouldn't be completely destroyed the way he does with, like, really loud music. Like, there's an action sequence that just feels completely at odds with anything else. Like, when he fights that man with his cane, it's just, like, the avalanche in the mountain is just, like, he tries to make it an action film in those sequences, and I just don't understand why. And the dialogue is great because there's all those subtleties of the characters who are all double-faced. And at the beginning, you think it's just another Poirot story with rich people murdering each other for money, and it's just like, oh, they all live in another world. But then there's this twist, and you realize that it's not just a Poirot story where all the rich people kill other people because they want their money. It's just something much more human than that.
Yeah, there should be much more of an emotional weight behind that part of the story, which I thought he did a very bad job of conveying.
It also arrives at this sort of moral junction, I suppose, at the end. And it left me, it was very unsatisfying because, you know, he builds up Poirot as this character of unimpeachable, moral intellect, and he just kind of chucks all that away at the end. And it's just bizarre. It's like, you've kind of inherited this character, this classic literary hero, basically, and you've kind of drawn out his like worst qualities in a way. It's a strange decision.
I think that's also due to the fact that I don't think, I'm sorry if I say this, but in this film anyway, I don't think Kenneth Branagh is really good. I don't think he should be the one playing Poirot. So at the end, when he has this, like, you know, it's like a big crisis for him to like have to make that decision or not make that decision, and I don't think Reed really felt for him in that moment because he played it so artificially, like he never felt like a real person. He just felt like someone with a moustache, and it was really not satisfying.
I think I agree. There is an attempt, I think, to cast us into submission here with the lineup: Johnny Depp, Michelle Pfeiffer, Branagh himself, Olivia Colman, Penelope Cruz, Willem Dafoe, Judi Dench, Derek Jacobi. I would say I wasn't actually bored during the film, so you know it did pass by. There was some nice shots of steam trains and stuff, and lots of actors going, But also, they handed out sausage sandwiches on the way in, which is always a bit of a red light on the dashboard.
Well, the screening that me and you went to, they put on a fairly small press screening for maybe like 30 people in like the biggest cinema in Leicester Square. And for the life of me, I couldn't work out why. And then I realised afterwards it's because he shot it on 65mm.
Ah.
So they projected it in this like wide format film, which he didn't need to shoot it in 65mm.
Also, if you're doing CGI anyway, does it work to...
It can complement it. I mean, ideally, yeah, he's making a kind of classic picture. A lot of the wider panoramic shots in this film, it's just CGI train going through some like beautiful landscapes. Mm.
Some of it looks like the Tintin. You remember the Spielberg Tintin film? It's a similar level.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I would happily watch a film version of that, you know,
right.
with done in that style. But Branagh's idea of what this film is very different to the reality of the film, I think.
Right. Okay. Bit of a miss then for Kenneth Branagh. What's he been up to lately?
Well, he's in Dunkirk.
Of course.
He pops up in things as an actor and does obviously a lot of stage work as well.
Mm.
I think this is the first thing he's directed since Cinderella a couple of years ago, which was a big hit. And I'm sure he'll be doing more of those kind of things. He's a sort of fairly safe pair of hands directorially. And I think this one may well make money as well.
I don't understand who will want to see it, because half of the people know the story and the other half, I don't know, like...
I think that given the time of year, it's going to be a big Christmas film, that because it has that feeling of the kind of movie that you would watch with relatives. Or
I think if this was a 90-minute TV movie and it came on at Christmas, and you know, you could sit and watch it with your nan, it would be great.
Right.
And if they maybe camped it up a little bit more, I feel like they didn't make enough of that. And the sort of period detail is quite lavish. Very evocative time period, and yeah, it felt quite kind of flat tonally, actually.
Was it just me that took exception to the contemporary chocolates?
What were the chocolates?
No, I saw them. I was really shocked by
and
that.
And I walked past their shop afterwards, and they got a big display in the window.
What is it, like M&M's or something?
No. That would be entertaining, but no, it's not. It's a luxury brand of chocolates, which is from various points in the film, it pops up. With
it's so strange.
It's really strangely done.
Oh, I have a sort of like product placement filter where I just...
Do you?
Yeah, I just don't sort of...
Oh, well done. But anyway, runs out of steam, would we say?
I think so. And really barely leaves the station.
Oof.
If we're going to run with train analogies.
Nice. Yeah. Numbers?
Maybe like 3 for anticipation. There's a curiosity, undeniable curiosity factor around this film.
As in, why is he doing it?
Why and like...
Oh, no, I was actually really looking forward to this, having seen the... I think the trailer makes it seem that there's a bit more of a modern spin on this than...
Yeah,
than
with
there
the music.
Is.
That's like, I think maybe Kanye West or something, and you're like, I'm sorry to say... Kenny West does not pop up.
He doesn't.
In this movie.
No. Yeah. If they could have been a bit more inventive or creative with the casting as well, just throw someone a bit from left field in there, like a pop star. Or so, you know, maybe put like Lady
Gaga.
Maybe
somebody actually from left field.
Well, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Or maybe have him being played by a Belgian person.
Yeah,
for once,
that would
we could get a
good.
Great accent.
Has he ever? I've got some notes here. Hold on, everybody. I've got some notes here. Here's a list of the people who have played. Hercule Poirot.
Well, David Suchet is the most
David
well-known,
Suchet.
I suppose.
Yeah, that's the TV version,
And Albert Finney played him in the 1974
Back in Sidney
film.
It's Sidney Lumet, is it? I had no idea the T was pronounced.
Oh, I don't know.
No, yeah.
Oh, there you go.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Alfred Molina and Mansai Nomura in 2015. Not a version I'm familiar with. But
no.
Kenneth Branagh, the fifth actor to embody Agatha Christie's famous detective. And interestingly, at the end, in the contemporary fashion, they set themselves up for... another in the series.
Yeah, bizarrely. I mean, yeah, I think a 3 in anticipation, a 2 at the time, and maybe a 1. I mean, if on that news, if they're going to do another one, my anticipation for that would be a 1. So I'm going to say 1 for in retrospect on this.
That'll do for me, Elena.
Anticipation, I guess it would be, say, 3, because, I mean, I thought the trailer was really funny. I was hoping it would be hilarious, but I don't think it was. So enjoyment, I would say 2. But it was nice to see... As much as I don't want Johnny Depp to get jobs because he beats women, it was nice to see him be the victim here, I guess. But yeah, I thought it was really boring and not necessary at all. So 2. And then in retrospect, yeah, 1, because it's just a waste of time.
Interesting area that takes us into, to what extent someone's craft, our appreciation of their craft should be influenced by our awareness of
I feel like it's difficult to separate them a lot of the time, even if, you know... You don't want to kind of judge someone for something they've done in their personal life. If you know something about someone, it's hard to, you know, separate that. I mean, the news that's been kind of rolling on this week, I think we mentioned on this podcast a few weeks ago about, you know, the sexual abuse scandal in Hollywood, and that is now, we predicted that it would roll on, and it has.
I think it's just good to give people the choice. Like, we just... tell people, okay, this actor has done this. I mean, you decide if you want to pay them, if you want to see the movie. But I think it's better... to tell people.
Yeah, I mean, the way this is kind of unfolding now, look ahead to like the Oscars, and they're going to be giving out awards
people,
to like a half-empty room.
I mean, it's going to be a weird time.
Yeah.
So there you go. Parts of Agatha Christie's original plot based on a very celebrated case. And as I say, I think that's really wasted the kind of whole emotional import of a very dark business kind of just glossed over in this film, and that's Murder on the Orient Express. Up next for us, The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Killing of a Sacred Deer, the latest film from Yorgos Lanthimos, concerns what happens when Stephen, a successful surgeon, takes a teenage boy under his wing and the unexpected consequences for his wife and two children. Here's a moment between Stephen and the boy, Martin, played by Barry Keoghan.
Can I tell you a secret? Don't tell her I told you. I think she likes you. I mean, she's attracted to you. But she says that's not true, but it is, I'm sure. And to be honest, I think you're perfect for each other. You'd make a great couple. She's got a great body. You've seen it for yourself. She lost weight and she's a really great figure.
Your mother is very beautiful, but the idea that she and I could ever be together is ludicrous. Let me remind you, I'm a married man. And I love my wife very much and my kids, and that we are very happy together. And for your information, you're absolutely fine. There's nothing wrong with you.
Ooh, my skin is crawling already, Elena.
Why?
Because it's such a creepy film, this.
Oh, it is.
And Martin, played by Barry Keoghan, is...
He's great.
So unsettling.
He is. Because also I think this movie, because the youngest Lanthimos thing that he seems to be doing now is to have these actors who are all quite famous. I mean, in Doctor they weren't famous, but they're from Lobster on, apparently they're all famous and Colin Farrell's been there. To get these actors and have them play in a very minimalistic style, just say the dialogue without having any emotions, and it's very creepy by itself. But then you have Barry Keoghan, who plays this character, this young kid, who kind of plays it more normally, and that's one of the many ways in which he's an element of chaos in the film.
Right. It's a really interesting idea that Lanthimos seems to be pursuing here, that cinema or theatrics are essentially a construct, and you don't need a realistic performance. All you need almost is just to reenact the movements. And I imagine this has been picked up on, but I mean, he's Greek, and this is so strongly evocative of Greek tragedy, no? The notion of fate and the implacable consequences of your own actions. And I believe as well the title comes from an element, one of the classic elements of Greek tragedy, the killing of a sacred deer.
Yes, it's based on a classical Greek myth that's really quite just as harrowing.
Mm. Colin Farrell apparently felt nauseous after he read for the film. The script had that much impact, but in a good way. I mean, it is from the opening shot of a little bit of open heart surgery. It's really unsettling, this film. But the filming, the way that it's put together, I mean, every scene is composed in magnificent fashion.
Yeah, I think it's actually real heart surgery that's taking place there. It's not mocked up or anything. So yeah. It does set the tone for just a really uncomfortable, uneasy ride, and he does deliver on that. I think my issue with it is that it starts off as a really ambiguous story. Colin Farrell and this young boy have a sort of vague connection. You don't really know much about either one and why they're kind of behaving the way they are towards each other. And eventually Lanthimos kind of shows his hand with the story, and it reveals the nature of their relationship. And I think from that point, I just became a little bit less interested in the whole thing.
Really?
I think it carries on in a really interesting way, but it also sort of sets out exactly what's going to happen and delivers exactly on that. Mm. I love the way he crafts this sort of dark ambiguity through very, very pitch black humour. And as much as he does carry on through the film, I think the point almost midway through the film at which he's like, here's what's going to happen.
Right.
It just kind of lost me.
I agree. He does show his hand, but then it becomes such an effectively suspenseful, almost horror film, that I didn't mind particularly the loss of the ambiguity. There's so many humorous touches in this film. There's bold and cheeky moves as well, like having a clip of Groundhog Day in the middle of it, which is a really dangerous thing for any filmmaker to do, because you naturally just want to keep watching that film.
I know that there were some moments that were like funny, but I didn't find it funny at all. Because I thought The Lobster was really funny in a very interesting, innovative way, like really dark. But what made the humour work to me is that there was so much heart and love in the film, in The Lobster.
Right.
Whereas I didn't think there was that much compassion in The Killing of Sacred Deer. I thought it was very artificial and kind of... Because in The Lobster, it's that world that's like horrible and like people can't have emotions. But then there's this love story that happens. Whereas in this, it's like yet another criticism of the family unit where people don't actually love each other. And I didn't think it was as interesting and moving.
Okay. The Lobster I really enjoyed for the first two-thirds, but the last half hour just left me bewildered. But I did like something which you have in this film again, that idea of a world constructed around an impossible but implacable logic that people try and escape from and ultimately can't, which is very much present in this. But I really thought this film was impressively put together. It wasn't for me an enjoyable watch at all. I mean, I had to go and have a lie down afterwards. It was that upsetting. But how easy is it, do you think, for the actors to take part in a film like this, to perform in such a almost machine-like fashion?
I don't know if it's easy, but it must be really fun. I would love to do that.
I think it would be really, especially someone like Colin Farrell. I mean, it's almost like not a kind of anti-performance, but he's not really acting in any way that you would expect from him or have seen him before. All of his little tics and mannerisms and inhibitions are sort of cast away. And yeah, it's kind of fascinating from just a performance point of view, this film.
Okay. Elena, you're not crazy about it, though.
No, I'm not. I was kind of disappointed because people have said so many amazing things about it. But I thought it was a bit glib. I thought it was, you know, someone trying to make a cynical film and not having that many great ideas behind it. And I thought it was, I had already seen it before, kind of. Mm. And it was kind of disappointing as well, because when I watched The Lobster, I was kind of blown away. And I thought, oh, there's so much in that world. There's so much imagination. There's so many elements that are funny and create an entire world. And whereas this, I thought it was I thought it would have been more funny and interesting if you had thought about all the details and like make it more complex. And I didn't really like the chamber effect of it.
Okay.
I mean, I know it's meant to be upsetting and it's creepy. And I thought that was obviously that's what he wants to do and it's really well done.
Right.
But I thought it was kind of to no purpose.
What would you say about Barry Keoghan's performance as Martin?
Oh, I think he's great. I mean, he was already great in Dunkirk, even though he didn't do much. But yeah, I mean, he was really a highlight. I want to see him in more films.
Right. Impressive cast, which also features Nicole Kidman working with Colin Farrell again, and also Alicia Silverstone.
Good to see how she turns up as Martin's mother, and has a particularly, I think, my favourite scene, actually, the scene where she's trying to corral Colin Farrell's character.
I think that's genuinely a funny and horrible scene.
Yeah, both. One of the many. Okay, Elena's not a fan. Adam, you?
As I say, it just sort of lost me at maybe like the midway point. I was left with this sense of, like, what's he trying to say or achieve here?
Yeah, me too.
And if it is just to make you feel miserable.
I don't think it is. I personally think the reason that I was so affected by this is because the enormous guilty conscience that I take around with me. I mentioned that this harks back, I think, in many ways to the Greek classical notions of the inevitable consequences of your own actions, that they will catch up with you, whatever intentions you might have since. And the notion of a man unable to escape his fate, a fate of his own creation, is something that really hit me hard. It's quite pitiless, the depiction of that. And I found that actually really struck home.
I'm not sure I found it quite as incisive as that.
Okay.
I just was wondering, you know, beyond the obvious like bleakness of it all, there wasn't really a lot else there to sort of latch onto. Like you say, in The Lobster, you have this romance that sort of develops later on into the plot. And with this, Lanthimos sets up this ultimatum about midway through the film, and the rest of the film is about what's going to happen there, basically. Mm. Colin Farrell has a decision to make, and I just didn't find it interesting either way.
Really? Because I found that ranked up there with, I don't watch a lot of horror films, but with, it's a bit like, I would imagine, not having seen any of them, the Saw films, like, do you chop your leg off to get away?
Yeah, I guess so. And maybe if it was pitched more as a sort of conventional horror film, I would have responded to it a bit more. Don't know. It just felt like he creates this very uneasy atmosphere. But to me, it just didn't really mount up to much.
All right. A broad spectrum of opinions once again here on Truth and Movies. Elena, would you like to express numerically your feelings on this film?
Well, anticipation, I would say 4, because I really like The Lobster, even though I had heard mixed things about this one from people I trust. And then enjoyment, I would say 3, maybe between 2 and 3, because I was really disappointed. And even the opening shot I thought was like basic and not scary. I mean, we all have like human hearts. Like, I'm not really scared of that anymore. I think I've seen it in so many films, I'm just like, yeah, cool.
Okay.
Anyway, and I could tell he was trying to make it like shocking, and I was just like, why are you trying to be shocking? It's not interesting. Anyway, and in retrospect, I would say still free because, as we just, I think, demonstrated, it's an interesting film to talk about. And I think it's more interesting than most films out there, and it's still worth seeing. And I am still looking forward to what Yorgos Lanthimos is going to do next. And the performances, like, I think Colin Farrell has done some of his best works in his movies. So
really great beard work as well.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Fabulous.
Yeah, I'm with you on the Colin Farrell thing. I think he's really like challenging himself as an actor with working like with people like Yorgos Lanthimos. And I think for me, I'd give this a 4 for anticipation, based not on Lobster so much, but on Dogtooth and some of his earlier films. Maybe a 3 at the time. I think it's just a 2 in retrospect. It didn't have enough like rewatch value for me.
Okay. I find it hard to put numbers on this because it was so unpleasant to watch, but I thought it was a really well-made film. I really found his artistic exploration of the whole notion of how much you need to have actors act in a film. As I say, everything being a construct. In the same way that Colin Farrell doesn't need to do an American accent if he's in a film, does he actually need to act, or can he just report the lines? So I thought that was really interesting. I really found the whole, what I took to be the philosophical theme of the film, interesting as well. But did I have fun watching it? No. I would say anticipation, nothing particularly high, but I think it's a really good film.
I think if you judge a film on like the director's intentions and to what extent they fulfil that, then you know he's clearly ticks the box, a big box there, because
he did.
It's not necessarily an enjoyable film in the conventional sense, but it is an effective film if you buy into the like atmosphere and the mood that he sets out.
Right. Excellent. Okay. Killing of a Sacred Deer out this Friday, as is That Business on a Train. This week's Film Club is up after this.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Are you here for Mother?
Yes. Yes, I am.
Wonderful. You're a godsend.
It's nothing.
Not to us, it's not.
Well, I'm glad to do it.
Vivian Ullman.
Samantha. Sam. Nice to meet you.
What's the matter, Sam?
Oh, nothing. I thought your husband went upstairs looking for you, and I didn't expect to see you come in from over there. I get disoriented sometimes. My friend Megan says I'm out to lunch.
I was downstairs in the basement looking for my furs. I just can't get used to this cold weather. I love the heat. We're from the desert, you know.
House of the Devil, everybody. In 1983, financially struggling college student Samantha Hughes takes a strange babysitting job that coincides, with a full lunar eclipse. She slowly realises that her clients harbour a terrifying secret, one which puts her life in mortal danger. What did listeners think of this then, Elena?
Daniel Fidler said, "My favourite horror film of all time." Lewis Edwards said, "Great film, nails the 80s look exquisitely."
Yeah, we had a nice longer email from Jeff, just as Jeff, who says, I've been listening to the podcast since the beginning, but it's the first time he's actually been able to catch one of our film club picks. And he says, seen a number of your selections already, I guess, so that's why. But yeah, interesting choice, left me in the middle of the road. On the one hand, it's amazing how 80s the film feels. If you didn't know any better, you'd swear it was made 30 years ago and not 8. That in itself is impressive. As for the horror movie element of it, though, it's pretty stock standard. And I kind of think that's the point of the film in a lot of ways. Yeah, he's trying to do something which is such a clear pastiche of 80s, like low-budget horror movies, that I almost feel it feels too accurate in its depiction of that.
Paul says, ahoy, crew. A film in two sections that I eventually enjoyed. Two-thirds production value of Emmerdale, and the pace of a five-course meal in an old people's home, then one-third extreme gore-punctuated frenetic Lucio Fulci. Is it Lucio Fulci?
Yeah.
Lucio. But yeah.
What did I call him? Lucio.
Yeah.
Yeah, Lucio.
It's the same.
Yeah. Lucio Fulci-esque madness. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
It's interesting comments because, you know, this is all intentional on the part of director Ty West, and basically nothing happens in the film. It's a quite short film, it's like 80 minutes. Nothing happens really until the last like 15 or so minutes in terms of the horror aspect of it. And he constructs this almost like mundane small town kind of story of this young girl and her friends. And there's so many scenes which are just very, very little happening. And you're kind of being lulled into this sense of full security, I suppose. And
oh, I didn't feel secure because of that. I felt completely terrified.
Oh, well, like I said, anything could happen at any time. Yeah.
I was so tense throughout the film, even though like nothing was happening until the very end, because I was just like, why is it so slow? Why is the camera not moving? Why is there that empty space in the frame? Is something going to happen? And I thought it was brilliant because it's so minimal. Like he had, and if you look at the film, so many things are just in close-up because I think it's because they couldn't afford to make everything look like the 70s or the 80s.
Right.
So they had to like focus on like, there are just a few settings and like no people there because we can't just have everyone wearing the clothes from the time. And I thought it was so brilliant. Like he really used his limitations brilliantly.
Shot on a budget and very, very quickly, I think 18 days for the whole production.
Mm.
But yeah, playing with your expectations of what an empty space will mean, of the implied...
Or just the fact that nothing happens. Mm. You're just like, well, something really horrible is going to happen because there's so much anticipation.
And even like the title cards or the opening title, when it appears on the screen, you know, it announces in massive yellow letters, this is a horror film, basically. And you're watching it thinking, you know, have they put on the wrong tape here? Like, what's going on? And when it delivers, I think it delivers like pretty well in the horror stakes towards the end. It depends what your threshold is for that stuff, I guess. But
yeah, I thought it wasn't completely terrifying, but it was fun and silly ending. Mm. Still scary, but not like the scariest thing I've ever seen, but still really scary.
What is the scariest thing you've ever seen, Elaine?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Let's say Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Really, I've never seen that. I get really easily spooked in films.
One of the scariest films I remember seeing at the cinema was The Others, which is, makes me sound like...
That's really chilling.
I love a kind of ghost story. Yeah. Like, gore doesn't really do a lot for me, as much as I can take enjoyment from the kind of practical craftsmanship of it. But yeah, watching that...
The Others was a fantastic film. That was...
That's Nicole Kidman as well.
Yeah, the director was...
Alejandro Amenabar, I think his name is. He's made a few other films, but I think that's probably his best one.
What about Ty West? What else has he done since?
I'm not sure whether this was his feature debut, but if not, it was one of his early ones. He made a film after this called The Innkeepers, which we actually ran on the cover of Little White Lies in like a Midnight Movies double special with The Raid. Innkeepers is a bit more comedic in tone, and it's set in a kind of hotel, basically, where all manner of horrors happen. And he's done a few things since then, maybe not like delivered on the promise of The Innkeepers and certainly House of the Devil, but he's an interesting one to kind of watch. Eleni, you mentioned that you'd...
Yes, he made that movie The Sacrament, which is basically based on the Jonestown Massacre. But like, what I really like is that it's almost completely accurate, everything that happens in the film. If you read the wiki page of what happened, it's literally what happened.
Oh, really?
But because I think it's really respectful to make it just inspired by, because this is literally all we know. We don't really know how it felt to live there. And it's just, there's not much enjoyment level to that film, but it's just very, very accurate and gives you a sense of how this could have happened. And it's quite brilliant.
Well, that's House of the Devil. What will we be having for Film Club next week? Well, amongst our featured films next week, Elena, is Paddington 2, which I know you're excited by.
Mm-hmm.
And Paddington 2 director Paul King is going to be joining us in the studio. Ahead of that, he has actually nominated a film for next week.
Hello, my name's Paul King. I'm the director of Paddington 2. And for the film club, I have chosen Frank Capra's 1939 masterpiece, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
So that's next week's film club. Many thanks to Paul King for that. And we'll be hearing much more from him in next week's Truth and Movies when we discuss Paddington 2. And also the Florida Project. Finally, I get to see this film that everybody's talking about.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's great.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just in case I'm not on next week.
All right.
I'm just going to say that I love the Florida Project. And I loved it, I think, from the first like 5 seconds of the film.
Right.
I was like, I'm going to love this film.
Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's nice then.
Not to build it up too much in your expectations.
No. Great. Well, it looks like being another fantastic edition of Truth and Movies next time out then. If you'd like to send in any comments and questions, as ever, truthandmovies@tcolondon.com is the email address. LW Lies on Twitter. There's our website, Little White Lies. And, well, we look forward to hearing from you. Elena, thank you so much for being with us. Have you got any other film-related news or otherwise you'd like to drop before we shut up shop?
No, not really. I mean, I would love to hear what people watch for Halloween.
Yes. Adam?
I actually went to see Call Me By Your Name again.
Ah.
For the third time.
Third time?
I had a joy watching it again, yeah. Went to an actual cinema with real people, and it was great seeing sort of people's reactions. So there was a lot of laughs, actually. I was not expecting, but people, you know, laughed at the appropriate moments. But, yeah, it was good.
I think it's always good to catch up again on people's views on films that they may or may not have reviewed here before. Elena, you've seen Call Me By Your Name?
Oh, yes, I have.
And were you very much a fan?
Oh, yes, I was.
Okay, I'm the only one who it slightly passed by.
What did you watch for Halloween?
Nothing, actually.
Oh. I've also been watching Stranger Things 2.
Yeah, I saw the first two episodes, but I've got a long way to go on
Which is very easy viewing, and, you know, that's not a criticism. It's well put together, but maybe less than some of its sort of influences.
Stranger Things, in general, is the reason that I didn't think that much of it, to be honest, because just thought Stranger Things did it that much better.
Fair enough.
Just before we go, the Blade Runner debate continues. One of our listeners this week saying they were very much on you and David's side of the divide on that.
Oh, wow. We'll tally that one up then.
Yeah. Elena, what's your take on Blade Runner?
I didn't like it.
You didn't?
No, I thought it was...
Again, it's just me.
I thought it was just a series of beautiful images, and that was not enough for me.
Not enough. But it's better than nothing. I mean, some of the heaped on.
It's not better than the original, despite what so many people are saying.
Oh, anyone who says that.
So many people are telling me it's better and also like an easier viewing and like more easier to understand. And I'm like, no.
They're wrong.
Blade Runner, the original, is great.
I'd agree with you on that, but I did think, in terms of seeing some beautiful things and really spectacular stuff on a big screen, it did that job. So I struggle a bit when people are too negative about it, because I just think, if you like cinema, this glorious-looking bit of art. But yeah, it could have done more, maybe.
I read a thing this week just talking about the fact that the film's a bit indulgent, and a sign of that is its runtime, which basically has meant that the cinemas can't show it more than like 3 times a day.
Yeah.
And that's massively impacted its box office.
Right.
And it's supposedly not going to break even because of that. So, which is a shame, because I like him as a director. I think it'd be good to see him doing
more. Yeah, that's a bit cruel.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay. All right, well, on that somewhat downbeat note, that's where we conclude today's Truth and Movies. Do join us again next time around. For now, this has been a 7 Digital production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.